The following program was pre-recorded on WFAN. It's time for Hello, My Name is Craig, our weekly candid conversation about gambling addiction. It's supported by the Council on Compulsive Gambling of New Jersey, 800-GAMBLER. Now, here's Craig Carton.
Good morning and welcome to another edition of Hello, My Name is Craig. Craig Carton with you as always for the next 30 minutes, a frank, open, honest conversation about gambling addiction. As always, joining us, my partner, Dan Trillaro. Good morning, Dan. How you doing today?
I'm doing great, Craig.
And joining us on the phone from West Palm Beach, Florida, is Lee V. Lee is also a gambler in recovery. Lee, good morning, and thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
If you don't mind me asking, how long has it been since your last wager?
It's been almost 6 years.
Congratulations. That's awesome. Awesome.
Thank you.
All right, I always like having women gamblers on the show because there is the notion that it's a problem that, you know, it's a guy problem. Now, while there's certainly more men that gamble than women, you know, women are just as susceptible to the disease and addiction of gambling as men are. When did you first start gambling?
Oh, wow. I've gambled pretty much my entire life, but I didn't gamble compulsively my entire life.
Sure.
It started when we were younger with competitions at home, whether they were board games, this, that, you know, marbles, whatever it was. And then I, again, in quotes, was normally gambling until it got out of hand, which was later in life.
So as a kid, nothing abnormal, like the normal American childhood growing up, you know, you might, you know, challenge your brother or parent to something and there might be a payoff, but nothing that was totally untoward, right?
No, nothing like that. Mm-mm.
So you had a background in it, not even knowing that maybe you were gambling. And then how old were you when you started to gamble where it then became a problem? And what were you gambling on?
I was probably around 40 years old. I was gambling solely on slot machines and solely probably on two or three of them. It started to progressively get out of hand, and I got myself into a situation where I felt as though I had to go at some point so that I could gain back the winnings that I had. I'm sorry, that gain back the losses right. that I had spent so that I could be even ultimately.
Looking back on it, when you first started to do it more frequently than you did prior in your life, were you hiding from something? Was there something going on in your life that it was bothering you where the slot machines gave you solace or made you feel good?
100%. So, and most of this I learned, honestly, after joining Gamblers Anonymous, as well as, you know, private therapy. I also went to treatment out in Minnesota. So I learned a lot in the process. I really immersed myself in my recovery. But what I found out is that basically I have an addictive personality in almost every aspect of my life, but that primarily in my earlier years, it was focused on work. So I was a workaholic. And I would suppress most of the things that had happened to me throughout my life in some way, shape, or form. I'd suppress them. I'd normalize them. And then I actually worked my way up. I've always had a wonderful work ethic and fortunate for that. And then I actually worked my way up to the president of a company, and I really worked hard, right? And so then I got to a point where I didn't have to work as hard. I had more time on my hands. And with that time, all of these things came, you know, just barreling me over, all these different emotions, all these different memories, and I didn't really know what to do with them, all these different situations that were coming back into my mind, and I could not turn my mind off. And I found that when I sat in front of these slot machines, it was the only thing that took my mind off of the other things, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, it makes total sense. And without pressing too much, were these traumatic things that happened when you were younger, or just things that, you know, you never actually processed, you know, health in a healthy manner?
Honestly, they were both. So when I was initially in treatment, I was asked if I had ever gone through anything traumatic, and my answer was no. And through continued questioning and assessments, I can break it down real quick. I was sexually, physically, emotionally, verbally abused by my father, as was my sister, as was my mother. I was outcasted by him. I was shamed and guilted and all of that good stuff. I spent a very good portion of my life punished. And in the home. And then I left my home at a very early age, about 14 or 15. I was living with a friend when I graduated high school. I then went into the military. I was raped in the military. And so I just say this to say that I've all of these things I had normalized and or said, you know, cognitively distortions. And,
well,
know,
let me stop you there. Maybe not even normalized it. And Dan, I want you to jump in on this. And this is just my word because we've similar backgrounds in that regard. Compartmentalized it, yeah. Maybe more so than normalized it, right, Dan?
Yeah, that's the word I was going to use too. And you just kind of tuck it away, and you put it away to that part of the brain where, and you lock it and throw away the key, and you're just not going to deal with that. And compartmentalize is the exact word I was thinking of, Craig.
So I'm going to take a guess here, Lee, and maybe I could be dead wrong. You're not really good, or you weren't really good. You know, sharing emotions, being in one-on-one conversations, and letting other people see the depth of you. Is that fair to guess?
Absolutely not. You know, showing any signs of weakness is how I was reared was absolutely taboo.
Yep.
You will never let anybody see you sweat. And that's really how my life went. When everything came to a head when I was 45 years old, and you know, we'll get into that, I'm sure, at some point, everybody was surprised. Everybody.
Yeah, because you become a world-class liar and hider of truth, even if you're not
absolutely
necessarily telling.
Lying,
you know,
manipulating,
yeah.
100%.
Yeah. So when you start, and again, you've clarity now you didn't have in the moment, so I totally respect that. But when you start playing slots more and more, give us an idea of how you define that. Was it every day you're in a casino? Was it 3 days a week? When you did go, were there like 18-hour marathons? How did you do it?
Oh, well, I can tell you that easily. It was progressive, right? So I started out a couple of hours a night, you know, on a weekend. And then, again, it progressively got worse over time. So let's say if I went on a weekend every now and then with my husband to just gamble, he never knew exactly how many times I went to the ATM. I was the sole breadwinner because I made a very good living as the president of the company.
Right.
And so it went from, let's say, one or two weekends a month to eventually 72-hour stints every day gambling on my way to work, on my way back, not showing up at work, taking phone calls outside of the casino so it was quiet, doing a lot of emailing and texting as opposed to answering the phone, all that good stuff. So, yeah, there was, you know, no self-care, multiple, you know, wouldn't go to the bathroom, wouldn't leave my seat, wouldn't want to, you know, jeopardize the loss of my machine, didn't want, you know, all of this good stuff. And I also, it was such lunacy. I was not in my right mind. I would set my alarm for 2 or 3 a.m. and I would leave because I also didn't want to be near anybody. I was very isolating. I was not one of these flash gamblers. Look at me. I was an escape gambler completely. I was also, again, after that, dealing with depression, anxiety, some, you know, undiagnosed, dual diagnosis things that, again,
sure,
all of this came to surface after I immersed myself in my recovery.
I mean, I really hate saying it, but it's like the female version of my life. I feel you.
Yeah.
I get every aspect of that. You know, when I was being a jackass, you know, wagering obscene amounts of money on the hands of blackjack, you know, it's contrary to what a lot of people think, what you see in casinos. I didn't want anybody to see me. I felt actually really uncomfortable, especially because people knew who I was. You know, if somebody saw me at a table with, you know, a $15,000 hand, that I was deathly afraid that somebody would see that. I wanted no part of that. The more private I could gamble, the better for me. Like, if there's a private room, I wanted it. I did not want the attention for gambling.
Absolutely.
So, as president of the company, you obviously had access to company funds. Did you ever go down that road where you started making, obviously you're making bad financial decisions with your own money. Did you ever borrow, steal, or use company funds or other people's funds and get yourself in a bind or no?
Absolutely. So after I had exhausted all of my funds, I absolutely helped myself took advances on future bonuses at first and would pay them back.
Right.
And then ultimately, I was not winning, so I couldn't pay them back. And then I got myself in such a hole that I really felt the only way to get out of this hole was to win. And I had no sense of, I truly had no sense of how much I was spending. All I knew was, if I'm not coming back with big wins that I'm able to put back into the bank, this is not good. So it finally got to a point where I literally was exhausted with robbing Peter to pay Paul, with juggling all the lies, with remembering who I told what to.
Right.
My depression was off the charts, and I became suicidal. And I thought, you know what? I put a plan together. I earmarked all of my life insurance policies, you know, circling the suicide clause because I had, you know, surpassed that. And so that wasn't an issue. I made a file on my computer that said death and wrote to my husband and said, these are the things you need to do. Cause I was also in charge of all bills, 401ks, investments, et cetera. And I just became suicidal knowing that that was the only way at that time I would be able to pay everybody back. And still, I was very well insured and still, leave my family enough money to live their lives in the way in which they were accustomed.
I'm going
to
stop you there. This is very, I'm so glad you're sharing this story. Dan Chilaro is always with us, Leaf down in Florida. This is Hello, My Name is Craig.
Back to more of Hello, My Name is Craig on The Fan with your host, Craig Carton, and supported by the Council on Compulsive Gambling of New Jersey, 800-GAMBLER.
Welcome back to Hello, My Name is Craig. Dan Chilaro. And Dan, every now and then we have someone special like Lee who tells a story that you and I can just kind of shut up and listen. And I think this is one of those days. When we left off, Lee, you just told us how you had prepared to die. The walls are caving in, the depression has set in, and you actually took painful steps to make sure that your debts would be paid and your husband and family would be okay financially. And, you know, I'm glad you brought that up because we do need to talk more about that because, you know, the suicide rates for gambling addicts is higher than any other addiction. Did you actually go through with the planning of how you were going to do it, when you were going to do it, where you were going to do it? Did you actually get that deep into it?
Absolutely. I had actually just had back spine surgery a month prior, so I had pain pills, you know, and so my plan was to take these pain pills with alcohol. By the way, I don't do drugs or drink, which is also a drug, but I don't do any of that. But this was my plan, and I was going to do it on Friday, the day that I actually placed my last bet. I was going to do it that afternoon. I contacted my outside accountant from the company and I called him and I said, okay, here's the situation. I need you to fly down this weekend. It was a Friday when I placed my last bet. I need you to fly down this weekend. I need you to be the executor of my will. And I'm going to go ahead and kill myself. And I've been taking money from the company and I need to do this so that I can pay everything back and, you know, sort of exit on a good note because now, you know, people will know that I paid everything back. And he proceeded to, God bless him, he proceeded to, we haven't talked a moment since, but he proceeded to try to calm me and say, okay, let me just see, you know, tried to talk me down. It wasn't working. And he said, all right, let me go check on flights and this and that. He then hung up the phone with me. I found out subsequently that he picked up the phone, called an owner of the company, and that sort of unfolded from that point on.
Wow. So that guy saved your life.
Well,
100%, and hasn't talked to me ever since.
Is that hard for you to process that you haven't spoken to the man who saved your life?
Not at all. And the reason it's not is because of my journey and what I've learned in recovery. So he is not at a place where he's ready to receive my amends, and I have to respect that.
Yep.
And I do respect it because I also understand that I didn't know what I didn't know. Now I'm in the know, and he's not there yet. So, and he may never be, and that's okay. I'm living my best life. I'm working a strong program, and I'm okay with that today. I'm more than okay with it.
So if, just to wrap up the story about, you know, you not going through with it, he calls the owner of the company, and I assume somebody rushes over to your house, apartment, wherever you're living, and saves you from yourself, makes you not do it, and, you know, it just doesn't end there. You know, you're an adult. You can go wherever you want. Do they get you into a hospital, a therapy program? Like, how did they actually go through the process of saving you?
Oh, it's actually a very long, detailed story, but I will try to keep it as short as possible. So I worked for a privately owned company, and I actually, my sister also worked for the same ownership, different company. So he called an owner, owner called my sister. Sister called me in hysterics, 7 years my senior she is, and she's an attorney, in-house general counsel for the company, and she called me begging me to, again, she called a therapist that I used to see. She just begged me to please not do anything, give her X amount of time to put some things in order and blah, blah, blah. And she kind of tugged on some heartstrings because she had always helped me my entire life. And I was like, I could at least do this, right? Because I know I'm going to kill myself. So yeah, 5 minutes later is not a big deal, right? Another hour is not a big deal. So that's how it happened. And then she flew down. My family rallied, my mother, my husband, my children. I called this 1-800 gambling line. You know, I did everything that I could do in a last ditch effort, in my opinion, to say, hey, I checked every box you asked me to check. Now I'm going to go kill myself. And fortunately, you know, God had another plan for me, and I'm very grateful for that.
So if that Friday's your last bet, you don't go through with, you know, suicide, you know, you're not well the next day. You don't have your come to Jesus moment necessarily, you know, 24 hours later, and then decide life is worth living. You know, how long did it take you to get to a place, whether it's in GA or it's private therapy, to take ownership of having a problem and recognize that suicide was not the way out?
I will tell you. So on Friday, I placed my last bet, made those phone calls. On Saturday, there was not a meeting that I was familiar with. I think on Saturday is when I called that 888 number. Sunday was my first meeting, and it was really on Sunday that I had planned on ending everything after the meeting. And I literally went into that meeting broken, hopeless, suicidal, and hysterically crying. And I left that meeting with hope. It was the most miraculous, life-changing thing. I found in the rooms this understanding, kindness, compassion, non-judgmental, and also hope that, you know, all of these people, different ages, different genders, different walks of life had really, they were laughing, they were hugging each other. And I went in saying, you know, oh, they don't know what I did. And then throughout this meeting and hearing the different therapies, they knew all too well what I had done. Some did worse, some did, you know, not as bad. And it just gave me a new perspective, and it gave me some hope that I didn't have. So I don't know exactly how long it took me from that point, but I can tell you that with the love of the fellowship and the people in it, and Arnie Wexler and different people, you know, throughout the program, that I just heeded all the advice that was given to me. I was the yes man. I did whatever they told me to do.
Dan, every time I hear a story, it's so reminiscent of when I went to rehab and said, no one knows how I think, no one knows how I process this, no one knows how I emotionally or mentally handle this. And every story I hear, man, woman, age is irrelevant. It's the same damn story. Like, we're all connected by this, you know, same exact way of processing this.
Yeah, you know, it's so funny. I think about the one of the six personality traits that lend itself to addiction is that nonconformity. You know, people who struggle with addiction, they don't conform. They think they're going to process everything differently. No one's going to get it. I'm different than you. But after spending the time with other people, you quickly realize, wow, there are people here. There's peer support. There's mutual aid. Like, people get it. And then that takes that isolation and it turns it into relationships. And then that's what kind of fuels that desire, that hope. And that's sometimes all we need, is just lighting that pilot light, right? I always think of it as a pilot light. And once it takes off, boy, it can really do some wonderful things.
So, Lee, you know, I usually like ending this show on a positive note, because there are people, you know, who are exactly where you were 6 years ago, who don't know if they want to wake up tomorrow, who don't think there's any possible way of getting their finances in order, of making amends to the people they've hurt, et cetera, et cetera. We've all gotten to a place, fortunately, where we can speak to the fact that you can overcome all this stuff. You can repair, you know, the damage, maybe not 100%, but a lot of it. And I would hope that you would, you know, speak to that person who's at day one of this, at step one, and let them know through your experience why you feel so strongly that they can get through day one and get to day two and year three and year six and on and on and on.
I can absolutely do that. I can tell you that I've lived it, so I know. I've not only lived it, and I'm not only a miracle of the program, but I've seen others. And I want to say this because I'm not proud of it necessarily, but it's part of my journey. So when I embezzled money from the company and had no idea how much that was, what happened was in my first 4 years of recovery, I was being investigated. I was, of course, working with them. I had admitted that I'd done everything. I was working with the company. The long story short is that the company didn't want to hurt me in any way. However, they needed to, in order to get their money back, they needed to file a police report. Turns out, and by the way, they could have told me I owed $10 million because that it didn't matter. I was so far gone, I would have believed them. Right. So I never challenged what they said I owed. So I went through this four-year investigation, and there were times, bumps in the road, where I wanted to give up and this and that, but the fellowship kept me going. My therapist kept me going. And so the long story short is, through that process where I was hopeless and broken, I not only had the support of the fellowship, but I also had guidance. So I was able to return to school while I was being investigated, earn my master's degree, and now I've rededicated my life to, I'm now a licensed psychotherapist specializing in gambling addiction and substance abuse addiction and behavioral addictions, et cetera, and so forth. And I also deal with dual diagnosis. So I've dedicated my entire life to really paying what I've been given forward. And again, it was life-changing. Walking into that room, yes, there were other supplemental sort of resources that I used. I did go to treatment for 30 days in Minnesota. It was exclusively for gambling.
Right.
You know, I had to put the work in. But if you are committed, if you have a desire to no longer gamble, to take the unmanageable life and make it manageable, it is absolutely within your reach. All you have to do is listen to the people that came before you and did it.
Is there any part of you that
in their footsteps?
Is there any part of you that misses gambling?
No, not one part of me.
That's awesome. Well, listen, I really appreciate you sharing your story. You know, you were a slots player, but it doesn't matter if it's slots or sports or, you know, keno or scratch-offs or blackjack. So I think it's really great that you're willing to share your story so publicly. And if I can ever return that favor, I'm in. And I'm so glad to hear that you're doing well. And I hope your family's still with you and you guys are doing well together. And keep it up because we're really proud of what you've done.
Thank you so much, and I really appreciate the opportunity to tell my story.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Dan, another, amazingly powerful and emotional story. I'm so glad she's willing to share it because, to me,
yeah.
You know, we need to hear more stories like that. We need to humanize this, as you and I talk about all the time. And from the lowest of lows, like the depths of getting ready to die, to 6 years later having this amazing, you know, fruitful life where she helps other people is just awesome.
You know, just pick up the phone if you're feeling some kind of way or if you're feeling a weak moment. You know, support is out there all the time.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And I think that's the most important message. There's always somebody that's willing to answer the phone. So please use it and pick it up, especially if you're feeling some sort of way that, you know it doesn't jive or isn't right. Or, you know, you feel depressed, by all means, pick up the phone. And as always, you can always call 1-800-GAMBLER in New Jersey. 24/7, that phone will get answered for sure. Dan, as always, appreciate it. Enjoy the rest of the weekend, and we'll do it again next Saturday morning. Thanks, pal.
Sounds great. Have a great week, Craig.
This was Hello, My Name is Craig. Have a great weekend.